Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 429, recording on Sunday, June 12th, 2022. My name is Rachel, and I am recording from my home studio in Boise, Idaho. So this week, we are focusing on worker health and safety laws, culminating in the landmark Occupational Safety and Health Act of 1970, signed into law by President Nixon after a long battle in Congress begun in the Johnson administration in 1968. However, the struggle to enact laws to protect worker safety and health began, as many of our stories do, in the Second Industrial Revolution. And I found a great resource on the Department of Labor website, DOL.gov. I found a great history of the lead up to OSHA, and I also am pulling from the Wikipedia article on OSHA. So, starting with the history of worker safety laws. As the Second Industrial Revolution ramped up, factory accidents increased exponentially through the 1870s and 80s. As state labor bureaus started to record the death and injury statistics, they began to call for states to enact laws to protect the health and safety of workers. In 1877, Massachusetts became the first state to pass a factory inspection law. It required adequate fire exits, guards on belts, shafts, and gears, and protection on elevators. Over the next decade or so, other states passed their own laws. Quoting from the DOL article, by 1890, 9 states provided for factory inspectors, 13 required machine guarding, and 21 made limited provision for health hazards. However, because there were only state laws, there were too many loopholes for factory owners to exploit. They would move operations to states with laxer health and safety laws. Also, states often lacked funding to employ inspectors to enforce the laws, and some inspectors even lacked the authority to enter factories without permission. Also, laws often couldn't keep up with innovations and had to be amended frequently to cover new hazards. In 1893, the first federal law to address workplace safety equipment was passed. The Safety Appliance Act required all trains to have air brakes and automatic couplers. It contributed to a drop in railroad deaths, but was obviously very narrow in scope. And we did do a whole episode on this topic, culminating in a brief discussion of this legislation and its implementation. It's episode 417, recorded in March of this year. Another big inciting incident was in 1907, a mine accident in Monongah, West Virginia, killed 362 coal miners, making it the deadliest U.S. mine disaster. This accident, combined with other mine collapses and explosions, led to the 1910 creation of the U.S. Bureau of Mines. At the same time, accident statistics in other industries were getting scrutinized. William B. Hard, a muckraking journalist, published Making Steel and Killing Men, an article about his investigation into a Chicago steel mill. He estimated that out of 10,000 workers, 1,200 were killed or seriously injured, a 12% accident or fatality rate, super high. U.S. Steel had already started collecting accident statistics on their own and formed a safety committee in 1908 to cut down accident rates. Their Safety First movement was emulated by other industries, and in 1915, a National Safety Council was formed. At this time, another field of study that sprung up at the turn of the century were industrial diseases. The U.S. Bureau of Labor started to publish gruesome pictures of industrial diseases and accidents to bring public attention to the issue of workplace health and safety. In 1910, they published a study of phosphorus necrosis, also known as phossy jaw, that resulted from the manufacture of white phosphorus matches. This study shocked the public, who demanded change. In 1912, Congress passed the Esch Act, which prohibitively taxed white phosphorus matches, and the Diamond Match Company released the patent for their alternative match head. In 1913, the Department of Labor was created, and William B. Wilson was named the first Secretary of the Department of Labor. We mentioned William B. Wilson on episode 335 from November 2020, and we discussed, among workplace safety and other things, his unsuccessful efforts to end child labor. A Senate resolution called on Wilson to report on industrial accidents and disease. As a former coal miner and union leader from the time he had himself been a preteen laborer in the mines, Wilson was already focused on increasing workplace safety and the health of workers. Quoting from the Department of Labor article, "Under Wilson, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, formerly the U.S. Bureau of Labor, started compiling regular accident statistics in the iron and steel industry and gradually included other industries. Wilson sought to establish the principle that, instead of feeding men, quote, into the maw of unhealthy occupations, the thing to do is to make the unhealthy occupations healthy," end quote. During World War I, there was a crisis in health and safety conditions in the war production industries. In response, Congress created the Working Conditions Service, who were authorized to inspect war production sites, advise companies on reducing hazards, and help states create and enforce health and safety standards. After the war ended, the service was allowed to expire, but all their records were kept for the future, quote, "when public and legislative opinion again shall have become focused upon the necessity for constructive organization of this character," end quote. After William B. Wilson's tenure, there was kind of a lack of focus on worker safety and workers' rights until FDR brought Frances Perkins on as his Secretary of Labor. And she renewed the focus on workplace safety and health, bringing her wealth of knowledge and experience from her time in New York working in occupational health and safety. In 1934, Perkins created the Bureau of Labor Standards, the first permanent federal agency established primarily to promote safety and health for the entire workforce. Her labor department managed to enact more successfully some of the items that had failed in the courts or in Congress back in the Wilson years. Quoting from the Department of Labor article, "Congress enacted three laws as part of Roosevelt's New Deal, which augmented the federal government's role in protecting people on the job. The Social Security Act of 1935 allowed the U.S. Public Health Service to fund industrial health programs run by state health departments. This made the Public Health Service, which had begun doing industrial health studies in 1914, the national leader in this field. The Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, which set a minimum wage and banned exploitative child labor, gave the Labor Department the power to bar workers under age 18 from dangerous occupations. And the Walsh-Healy Public Contracts Act of 1936 allowed the department to ban contract work done under hazardous conditions. By the 1950s, the state-federal partnership that Perkins cultivated couldn't keep up with new and emerging hazards, and the federal government took on a more prominent role in worker health and safety. In 1958, the Democratic Congress passed a seemingly minor amendment to the Longshoremen's and Harbor Workers' Compensation Act. It gave the Labor Department authority to set safety and health standards for the very small workforce covered under this law. In addition to protecting workers in one of the nation's most hazardous industries, the amendment closed the last remaining no man's land in safety enforcement. The Secretary of Labor was authorized to seek penalties against willful violators, but not against those who only carelessly broke the rules. After holding public hearings, the department began enforcing standards in 1960. Compliance was good, and the high accident rates declined sharply. In December 1960, as the Eisenhower administration was on the way out, Department of Labor released a set of mandatory health and safety standards under the Walsh-Healy Act. Prior to this, all Department of Labor standards were published in a quote-unquote green book of informal guidelines to help states create and enforce their own standards. The backlash from both labor and business was swift and vehement. They were surprised by the announcement and angry that they weren't consulted. States also felt undermined by the federal agency enacting their standards that superseded the state standards. The department under the Kennedy-Johnson administrations took the criticism seriously, and in October of 1963, they announced proposed revisions, with hearings to be held in March 1964. The hearings ran for 2 weeks, and many witnesses from industry testified. Business felt that the new mandatory rules weakened their long-established pattern of voluntary safety efforts and would stifle innovation. After the hearings, the department conducted their own study of their safety programs. An outside consultant found a fragmented collection of programs and laws and recommended that a single agency bring all these collected programs under one umbrella. While this examination of department practices occurred, there was a growing environmental movement concerned with how industrial chemicals affected the safety of water and air. Spurred by this movement, in 1965, the Public Health Service produced a report, Protecting the Health of 80 Million Americans, which outlined some of the recently found technological dangers. It noted that a new chemical entered the workplace every 20 minutes, that evidence now showed a strong link between cancer in the workplace, and that old problems were far from being eliminated. The report called for a major national occupational health effort centered in the Public Health Service. On May 23, 1966, Johnson told a meeting of labor reporters that, quote, "the time has come to do something about the effects of a working man's job on his health," end quote. The Departments of Labor and the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare promptly set about to develop legislation for such a program. A joint task force was then to combine both departments' ideas and submit a proposal to the president. However, Labor and HEW could not agree on which department would control a national program, and by late 1966, the task force was deadlocked. Amidst this deadlock, it was revealed that almost 100 uranium mine workers had died of lung cancer since the 1940s, and up to 1,000 more deaths were expected. In 1947, the Atomic Energy Commission determined that radiation levels in these mines were dangerously high and began a long-term study of the miners, along with the Public Health Service. Although many federal agencies had jurisdiction over uranium mines, no one agency had clear responsibility for mine safety, and there was very little enforcement. The lack of action took on tragic overtones with the revelations of 1967, and public attention focused on the Federal Radiation Council, created in 1959 to advise the president on protective measures to take against all types of radiation hazards. The council was composed of representatives from concerned agencies. In 1967, they had just completed a study of the uranium mines and was expected to recommend a standard shortly. However, when the council met on May 4, 1967, it became deadlocked between a standard that the Atomic Energy Commission recommended and a tougher one preferred by the Labor Department. The next day, Labor Secretary Willard Wirtz, frustrated by the lack of action taken, used the Walsh-Healy Act to enact his department standard. This move helped shape a national health and safety program as the Board of the Budget moved forward with the DOL's proposals over HEW's. So at this point, the Department of Labor was really stepping forward to take control of shaping what a national health and safety program would look like. In January 1968, President Johnson asked Congress to pass a job safety and health program conforming to the recommendations of the Department of Labor. Johnson said it was, quote, "the shame of a modern industrial nation," end quote, that each year more than 14,000 workers were killed and 2.2 million injured on the job. Citing inadequate standards, lagging research, poor enforcement of laws, shortages of safety and health personnel, and a patchwork of ineffective federal laws, Johnson argued that a comprehensive new law was needed. The bill was supported by labor, but strongly opposed by business. It gave the Secretary of Labor the responsibility of setting and enforcing standards to protect 50 million workers. The bill also had a general duty clause requiring employers to, quote, "furnish employment and place of employment which are safe and healthful," end quote. It gave inspectors legal authority to enter workplaces without management's permission without prior notice. Violators could be fined or jailed, and the Secretary could blacklist transgressors who held government contracts. The Labor Department would help interested states to develop their own programs in lieu of the federal one. The Department of HEW would provide the Labor Department with scientific material for new safety and health standards. Opponents, especially from industry, said that it was too far-reaching and gave the Department of Labor too much power. Ultimately, the bill failed before it even came up for a vote. In 1969, after President Johnson left, and President Nixon came on. President Nixon started working on his own health and safety program alongside Department of Labor Undersecretary James D. Hodgson, who became Secretary of Labor when Secretary George Shultz left the DOL to become the Director of the Office of Management and Budget. The Nixon administration's proposal bypassed the question of whether labor or HEW should have control and offered instead a five-person board that would set and enforce job safety and health standards. The Labor Department would be limited to inspecting workplaces, and HEW would do research. Nixon emphasized use of existing efforts by private industry and state governments. The main federal concern would be with health research and education and training, and only secondarily with direct regulation. Nixon introduced two bills that covered worker health and safety. However, Representative James G. O'Hara and Senator Harrison A. Williams introduced much stricter bills similar to the Johnson legislation of the year before. In response to the competing bills, Republicans introduced a compromise bill. The compromise bill established the Independent Research and Standard-Setting Board favored by Nixon while creating a new enforcement agency. The compromise bill also gave the Department of Labor the power to litigate on the enforcement agency's behalf, as in the Democratic bill. In November 1970, both chambers acted. The House passed the Republican compromise bill, while the Senate passed the stricter Democratic bill, which now included the general duty clause that I mentioned earlier. A conference committee considered the final bill in early December 1970. In exchange for a Republican proposal to establish an independent occupational health and safety research agency, Democrats won inclusion of the general duty clause and the right for union representatives to accompany a federal inspector during inspections. The conference committee bill passed both chambers on December 17, 1970, and President Nixon signed the bill on December 29, 1970. The act went into effect on April 28, 1971. So what does the act do? First, it created the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, an agency under the Department of Labor. OSHA has the authority to set and enforce worker health and safety standards. It also created the Independent Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission to review enforcement priorities, actions, and cases. It also established the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, also known as NIOSH, an independent research institute in the then Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, now under the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The act defined an employer as any, quote, person engaged in a business affecting commerce who has employees, but does not include the United States or any state or political subdivision of a state, end quote. It covers churches and religious institutions if they employ workers for secular purposes. However, the act excludes the self-employed, family farms, workplaces covered by other federal laws, such as mining, nuclear weapons manufacture, railroads, and airlines, and state and local governments, unless state law permits otherwise. The act covers federal agencies and the United States Postal Service. Section 5 of the act contains the General Duty Clause. The General Duty Clause requires employers to, 1, maintain conditions or adopt practices reasonably necessary and appropriate to protect workers on the job, 2, be familiar with and comply with standards applicable to their establishments, and 3, ensure that employees have and use personal protective equipment when required for safety and health. OSHA has established regulations for when it may act under the General Duty Clause. The four criteria are, 1, there must be a hazard, 2, the hazard must be a recognized hazard, for example, the employer knew or should have known about the hazard is obvious, or the hazard is a recognized one within the industry, 3, the hazard could cause or is likely to cause serious harm or death, and 4, the hazard must be correctable. OSHA recognizes not all hazards are correctable. So these criteria are really hard to meet because you have to tick all four boxes, and that is quite difficult. So due to the difficulty of the rulemaking process, which is governed by the Administrative Procedures Act, OSHA has focused on basic mechanical and chemical hazards rather than procedures. Major areas which its standards currently cover are toxic substances, harmful physical agents, electrical hazards, fall hazards, hazards associated with trenches and digging, hazardous waste, infectious disease, fire and explosion dangers, dangerous atmospheres, machine hazards, and confined spaces. Section 8 of the Act covers reporting requirements. All employers must report to OSHA within 8 hours if an employee dies from a work-related incident, or three or more employees are hospitalized as a result of a work-related incident. Additionally, all fatal, on-the-job heart attacks must also be reported. Section 8 permits OSHA inspectors to enter, inspect, and investigate, during regular working hours, any workplace covered by the Act. Employers must also communicate with employees about hazards in the workplace. By regulation, OSHA requires that employers keep a record of every non-consumer chemical product used in the workplace. Detailed technical bulletins called Material Safety Data Sheets, or MSDSs, must be posted and available for employees to read and use to avoid chemical hazards. OSHA also requires employers to report on every injury or job-related illness requiring medical treatment, other than first aid, on OSHA Form 300, Log of Work-Related Injuries and Illnesses, known as an OSHA log, or Form 300. An annual summary is also required and must be posted for 3 months, and records must be kept for at least 5 years. Section 11C of the Act prohibits any employer from discharging, retaliating, or discriminating against any employee because the worker has exercised rights under the Act. These rights include complaining to OSHA and seeking an OSHA inspection, participating in an OSHA inspection, and participating or testifying in any proceeding related to an OSHA inspection. Section 18 of the Act permits and encourages states to adopt their own occupational safety and health plans, so long as the state standards and enforcement are or will be at least as effective in providing safe and healthful employment as the federal OSHA Act. So what difference has this Act made? I found some stats on the OSHA.gov website that are current to the year 2019. So federal OSHA is a small agency. With their state partners, they have approximately 1,850 inspectors responsible for the health and safety of 130 million workers employed at more than 8 million worksites around the nation. This translates to about one compliance officer for every 70,000 workers. Federal OSHA has 10 regional offices and 85 local area offices. In the year 2019, 5,333 workers died on the job. This is 3.5 workers per 100,000 full-time equivalent workers. On average, more than 100 a week, or about 15 deaths every day. About 20% of worker fatalities in private industry in calendar year 2019 were in construction, and this accounted for 1 in 5 worker deaths for the year. Worker deaths in America are down, on average, from about 38 worker deaths a day in 1970 to 15 a day in 2019. Worker injuries and illnesses are also down, from 10.9 incidents per 100 workers in 1972 to 2.8 per 100 in 2019. So it has made a pretty big difference on workplace health and safety. However, it is kind of concerning that there's only one compliance officer for every 70,000 workers. It really makes you wonder how responsive OSHA can be to a complaint and if they have enough time to inspect workplaces and enforce the laws. I think enforcement is probably a big stumbling block given that number of inspectors that are employed by the federal government. So it's kind of interesting. I think a big part of what has been so successful is encouraging states to enact their own safety laws and also really creating this culture of safety, of workplace safety. As mentioned before, there was a lot of voluntary private industry workplace safety studies going on. So I think OSHA just merely augmented that and emphasized that worker safety that was already kind of happening, but codifying it and making it more solid in federal law. So this website does include up to 2019. So obviously it does not account for COVID injuries and illnesses and deaths. So because we are talking about 2019, that is a good benchmark year to compare to 1970. Obviously COVID has changed the math on that. So 2019 would be a good comparator year versus say 2020 or 2021. So I think overall it has contributed to a drop in worker injuries and deaths that have been very effective. One thing I wanted to highlight was the material safety data sheets. that are required to be stored on site at the job. That is something I run into every day. There are safety signs everywhere at work. If you've ever been around a chemical, you've seen that like safety diamond where it shows how flammable a chemical is, how reactive it is, how hazardous it is. So those are all a result of OSHA standards. We talked before about hard hats. So PPE is a big part of OSHA. So all these things have contributed to workplace safety and have become ubiquitous. It's not even something you remark upon. You see the safety signs posted and it doesn't really flag as unusual because it's just everywhere. So as always, all our sources and show notes will be posted on arsenalfordemocracy.com. I found this to be a very interesting topic to research. I didn't know about the history and the roots stretching back all the way to the Second Industrial Revolution. So even though we were talking about OSHA being relatively recent, it all comes back to the 1870s, it seems. We can't escape it. So I found it really interesting how, again, our working conditions today have their roots in the Second Industrial Revolution. And I hope you enjoyed this topic as much as I did. As always, thank you for listening. If you like us, please subscribe to our Patreon, patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy. For just a few extra bucks, you can get some extra episodes and the satisfaction that you're supporting this great historical podcast. So thanks for listening.